It was September 1976. I was stunned by the notice that I just received in the archaeological journals. Across the front pages of the Jerusalem Post, dated August 24th, 1976, was a reference to a newly published fragment from the Cairo Geniza. Here, Asher Wallfish in the Jerusalem Post summarized a very interesting announcement. Medieval Jewish apologetics on the life of Jesus have now been enriched by a Jerusalem scholar's interpretation of a hereto unpublished item from the Cairo Geniza, in the possession of Cambridge University in England. Zev Falk, a law professor at the Hebrew University, who photographed the Oriental Jewish document in Cambridge recently and deciphered it here last week, sees in it a possibly new Jewish approach to Jesus' life. The material, written in Aramaic, resembles no more than a handful of similar writings current at the time among Eastern Jewry. Among European Jews in the Middle Ages, he notes, apologetic writings circulating in the community to help refute Christian propaganda were far more common than in the East. Falk's document, this announcement in the Jerusalem Post continued, is a single page written on both sides and part of a larger manuscript reflects Talmudic references to Jesus, New Testament information, and probably independent Jewish oral traditions. It takes up the story with the episode of John the Baptist and breaks off with the inquiry among the Jews about the scriptural sources used by Jesus in his preachings. The John story is identical with a version of Josephus, the Jewish historian of the Roman era. The document mentions the Emperor Tiberius, by whom it probably means King Herod Antipas. Similarly, it refers to 11 apostles, though not giving all of them the same name as in the New Testament. Most Jewish sources talk of the five apostles, Professor Falk pointed out. Falk notes that the four or five Oriental Jewish apologetic writings on Jesus, previously known, concentrate on the later period in his life and around his crucifixion. An article on the document will be published in the Tarbitz Journal of Jewish Studies. Now, the term Geniza was used for the storeroom in Jewish synagogues where sacred books and scrolls as well as other important writings were kept instead of being destroyed after their physical condition deteriorated and made them unfit for ordinary use. The famous Cairo Geniza, part of which is now in Cambridge, contained more than 250,000 documents. Let's discuss the discovery and recovery of these documents for a while in Cairo, Egypt. Sweeping across the Middle East and North Africa, the Persians in 600 BC conquered Egypt and erected fortresses along the Nile. Later on, the Roman conquests also resulted in the erection of fortresses, one of these in Egypt at a place called Qasr al-Shama, which was to be settled later by the Arabs and called Fustat. During the Christian centuries, six churches were situated in Fustat. One of these was the Church of St. Michael. It was the last one held by the Christian Melchite group when most of the churches throughout Egypt had passed into the hands of the Jacobite Christian group. The violent antipathy of the two factions gave cause of quarrel and conquest to the Jacobites after the Roman decline and Arab conquest. The Arabs established Fustat and embracing the fortresses, the churches, and the settled areas. Today we know this ancient area of Fustat as South Cairo. 1,000 years after the Persian conquest of modern Iran, the Persians again conquered the area, and under their rule in 1616, the churches were transferred to the Jews. Again, the ancient Fustat, or city of Cairo, changed hands as Muhammad rode full stride over the Mediterranean world. After the Arab conquest, the churches reverted to the Christians again, but during the reign of the famous Ahmed ibn Tulun, who ruled Egypt from AD 868 to 884, the Coptic Patriarch Michael, the 56th patriarch, who died in 901, was ordered to pay the government 20,000 dinars. In order to raise this sum, the patriarch had to sell some church properties to the Jews. This included the sale of the Church of St. Michael. In 1882, the Church of St. Michael was converted by the Jews into a synagogue. After long use, the synagogue was rebuilt in 1890, but the geniza was left unaltered. Most Hebrew synagogues, at least since the early Middle Ages, included a closet or a vault, a room called a geniza. This is a Hebrew word referring to hiding or burial. The geniza served as a form of morgue for the deposit and disposal of materials bearing writings because the sacred name of God was written upon them. They either had to be placed away or buried. Eventually, the geniza came to receive not only used or mutilated texts, but also faulty ones that were not permitted to circulate, either because they contained errors or corrections by the scribes. Until recently, no Hebrew Old Testament text older than the 9th century, and though these are rare enough, had come down to us because of their purposeful elimination by the process of the genezes. The Cairo geniza is outstanding because much of its contents were untouched and perhaps even forgotten for the better part of 1,000 years. That these manuscripts survived was entirely unintentional. Or was it? This geniza belonged to one of the oldest synagogues in one of the oldest Jewish communities of the dispersion, and it had existed throughout the golden age of Arab civilization. The ancient synagogue, variously named for Ezra, Elijah, Jeremiah, or Moses, was finally called Ezra in our time. The first modern traveler who appears to have known of the geniza was a man called Heinrich Heine. He was the great uncle of Simon van Gelderen, who visited it in the mid-18th century, about 1750, and wrote in his diary of the likelihood that valuable manuscripts were buried there. But it was mere chance that the Cairo geniza was forgotten and that its contents so escaped the fate of other genizas. Very much against the will of those who had stored them, no doubt, these ancient materials had escaped final burial. Now, when in the course of the last century the Cairo geniza was rediscovered, the chiefs of the synagogue to which it belonged made the surprising discovery that there were some curious people in the world who were attracted by the old materials, who were willing even to pay a considerable amount of money for these scraps of dirty parchments and papers, and that even renowned universities were extremely interested in the contents. Now, the Jewish traveler and Hebrew scholar and explorer, known for his explorations in Yemen, Jacob Safier, had heard of the geniza when he was in Cairo in 1864. He was anxious to visit it and to make some discoveries there. He obtained a permit of the rabbis to enter the room. Despite the beadle's warning that serpents and dragons were lurking in the closed dark room, he braved the Nilotic beasts and plowed through the debris for 2 days, until he had taken his fill of dust and dirt. He did not find anything worthwhile, but he did take a few leaves. And in his remarkable travelogue, he wrote, "Who knows what may yet be beneath the pile of dirt and filth?" Soon after him, Abraham Berkowitz, on a journey to the east, came to Cairo. Abraham was a Karaite Jew from the Crimean Peninsula, of somewhat ill fame on account of the falsification he made on dates of gravestones and on Hebrew manuscripts in order to show to the authorities in Russia that the Karaites had been settled in the Crimea for a much longer time than was previously accepted, and to get some concessions from the Tsars. Firkovich has the credit of bringing together the largest collection of Hebrew manuscripts which exists in the world. These manuscripts form the two Firkovich collections in the Russian Public Library at Leningrad. Hopefully, I plan on being there in 1982. The first was sold to the library by Firkovich himself. The second was acquired by the library in 1876, soon after his death on the 26th of May, 1874. How much material he obtained from the Cairo Genzi at his visit, we don't know, but it was considerable. It included the Hebrew Bible and Masorah. His collection in Leningrad includes writings on parchment alone numbering more than 1,582. Those writings on paper, 725. This is considerable when you realize that the British Museum has a catalog of only 161 such documents. And the great Kennicott, who tried to use all of the old Hebrew manuscripts available in his time in Europe for his great Old Testament in Hebrew, was not able to collate even as many as one-third of the number of manuscripts which are today to be found in the one collection alone in the Leningrad Library. The so-called Babylonian Codex of the Prophets, dating A.D. 916, belongs to another smaller collection also in the Leningrad Library, and has been regarded for a long time as the oldest dated manuscript of the Hebrew Bible, until the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls and other fragments in Egypt. Aaron ben Moshe ben Asher, the famous Rabbi Asher, the greatest Masoretic authority, who was finally responsible for the exact punctuations and the exact Masorah of the Tiberian text, which we have in our present Bibles, flourished in the first half of the 10th century A.D. So therefore, there cannot exist any codices dependent on this authority or the authority of ben Asher before that date. Also found in the Leningrad Library in the autumn of 1926 were a number of other documents, 14 Hebrew Bible manuscripts, which can be dated between 929 and 1121. And all of these manuscripts contain in the main the text fixed by ben Asher. These were noted by Dr. Cale, who was a very good friend of Solomon Schechter, the discoverer of the manuscripts of the Kairogenzia. But the biblical manuscripts are only a small part of the Firkowitz collection in Leningrad. No catalog of this collection exists as yet. Firkowitz was very expert at ransacking old synagogues and their genizes. In the summer of 1908, when Cale was in Nablus for a period of time, he visited an old Samaritan high priest who well remembered Firkowitz's visit there 40 years earlier. He spoke with great indignation of the man and the way in which he deceived the Samaritan priest and took away great quantities of valuable old Samaritan manuscripts, paying them practically nothing. Nevertheless, it was due to Firkowitz's activity that the Russian Public Library possesses the greatest collection of Samaritan manuscripts in Europe as well. There can be no doubt that a certain quantity of the manuscripts of the great collection in Leningrad came from the Cairo Geniza. We hear that Firkowitz did not enter the place himself, but that he acquired bundles of manuscripts from it. And as he was a great expert in manuscripts, he did not gather material at random. He knew how to select important material, and without any doubt, some of the most valuable fragments of the Geniza are in the collection in Leningrad. But Firkowitz had an interest in concealing the way in which he used to collect his material and the places from which it came. So today nobody is able to say exactly how far the collection in Leningrad is from the Kairogeneza. There also in the Leningrad Library is a collection of nearly 1,200 fragments which undoubtedly also came from the Kairogeneza. This is called the Antonin Collection, but it was brought together by Antonin, a Russian Archimedrite, in Jerusalem. Cale saw those fragments in 1926 in Leningrad. In 1896, Elkan Natan L. Adler, the brother of the English chief rabbi, Dr. Herman Adler, had an opportunity to enter the Geniza and of bringing away from it a sack full of fragments, of which a certain amount came later to the library of the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York. And then about 1890, when the synagogue of Old Cairo was being rebuilt, that we referred to earlier, the Jews began to make a general trade with the materials of the Geniza, and great quantities of the fragments were sold and brought over to Europe by travelers, especially to the Bodleian Library in Oxford, where Niebuhr and Colley were equally interested in such matters and eager to come into possession of materials from the Geniza. Today, the Bodleian Library has, next to Cambridge, the largest collection of the Cairo Geniza fragments. And it and the British Museum are the only libraries which are in possession of any of this material to have a printed catalog. When the synagogue was redecorated in 1890, the Geniza's existence became better known, and the beadles of the synagogue began to realize the propensity of dealers in Cairo
who desired to purchase this refuse of centuries. Thus, within a few years, masses of Geniza scraps filtered into the hands of private collectors in the libraries of the West, in the Bodleian, the British Museum, Frankfurt, Berlin, Philadelphia, Budapest, and many others. In 1896, when E.N. Adler revisited Cairo Synagogue and was allowed to spend 3 or 4 hours inside, he was allowed to take away all he could carry in an old Torah mantle, which he borrowed for the purposes. A few fragments also found their way to the University Library in Cambridge, not the most important. Some came to the British Museum. A comparatively large collection came to the Bibliothèque of Alliance in Paris for Israel, where Israel Levi was greatly interested in such things. Some fragments came to the Frankfurt am Main, famous as possessing the most complete collection of Jewish books on the continent. Here, Dr. Freeman, one of the librarians, was interested in this material. Some fragments also came to other libraries at Strasbourg and in Berlin, and 4,000 fragments were collected by Jack Mosery in Cairo likewise. A new turn was given to the matter, however, in 1896, when two learned Scottish ladies, Mrs. Agnew Smith Lewis and Mrs. Margaret Dunlop Gibson, they came back to Cambridge from one of their many journeys to the East. A story on these two young ladies would be most exciting just alone. They had also bought in Cairo some fragments from the Geniza. In Cambridge University, Schechter, at that time, Solomon Schechter, examined some of the fragments which they brought to him. He pointed out that the parchment belonged to a manuscript of the Palestinian Talmud, of which he was an expert. He was a reader in Talmudic at Cambridge, as a matter of fact. And in the proper fragments, as he examined them, he noticed a paper fragment with the Hebrew text of Jesus ben Sira, Ecclesiasticus in the Old Testament, a Jewish text composed in Hebrew shortly after 200 BC or earlier. This text was known only in the Greek translation contained in the Septuagint and in other translations, but so far nothing was known of the text in the original Hebrew. Now here was a small Hebrew fragment which had once been a part of the Hebrew literature. So it was decided quite secretly that other materials would be made available and to send Schechter to Cairo so that he might try to bring back to Cambridge whatever he could find there. Dr. Charles Taylor, the master of St. John's College in Cambridge, a mathematician and others, gave Schechter the money for his remarkable journey to Cairo, 1896. Schechter, this was one of the great journeys for him. He was provided with a recommendation from Cambridge University, an address to the president of the Jewish community at Cairo, saying that he undertook the journey on behalf of the Cambridge University Library. He left in December 1896. A letter of introduction from Elkin N. Adler in London to the chief rabbi of Cairo was also obtained. This helped Schechter to get in contact with the right individuals. With this individual's help, he got permission to enter the Geniza and to take with him everything he wanted. To work in the dark and dusty room was certainly no easy task, but with his great energy and enthusiasm, he achieved his object within a few weeks. Schechter had permission to take with him the whole contents, but he decided to select all the written fragments and to leave there all the printed ones. So we can understand his decision, and only a general selection was possible in the circumstances because of availability of space, time, and transport. He did not realize the importance of the printed materials. Printed fragments revealed very interesting facts about the history of Hebrew printing in the 4th, 15th, and 16th centuries. Schechter, perhaps a little bit way of by background, had been raised in the ghetto in Eastern Europe. Until he went well into his 20s, he had had no secular education. He ended up at the University of Vienna and then in Berlin, and he encountered Western learning for the first time. He did not, unlike so many gifted Jews of the time, abandon his beliefs or adapt the attitudes of the Western intelligentsia. He did not seem to bear any emotional scars from his ghetto life or from the severe discipline of Talmudic studies, which he began at the age of 3. He was born in 1847 in the little Romanian town of Foscani in the Carpathian Mountains, to which his father, who occupied the humble office of ritual slaughterer, had migrated from Russia. Though reputedly the roughest boy in town, young Solomon Schechter was quickly recognized as a wunderkind, a child prodigy in Talmudic learning. At the age of 5, he knew the Pentateuch, the first 5 books of the Bible, by heart. One of the great influences in his life was the incisive method of the German historical school, however. He was one of the first to apply meticulous textual study to Jewish religious literature. Simultaneously, he acquired an abiding interest in the old manuscripts, which were the basis of all such work. Thus, for him, began his lifelong enterprise of editing some of the ancient Talmudic and Midrashic studies. He was being prepared. It is certain that in the future, Judaism will find its center of gravity in America. And on that certainty that he felt, and for this and other reasons, he gave up the beloved academic groves of Cambridge in the later part of his life to spend his last 12 years in New York as president of the Jewish Theological Seminary. Now, during his studies in London, he became interested in the Apocryphon Ecclesiasticus by Jesus ben Sira, a book which until then had survived only in quite unsatisfactory translations and then only in Greek. He was thus fully prepared for what was now in store for him. Probably no other Jewish scholar alive at the time was as well qualified to identify an entirely unexpected Hebrew fragment from the wisdom of Jesus ben Sira, or to be able to provide the necessary energy and expertise required by the documents of the Cairo Geniza. Shortly after Mrs. Lewis and Mrs. Gibson decided to get in touch with Schechter, Mrs. Lewis ran into him on King's Parade in Cambridge and told him about the manuscript she wanted to show him. She continued her shopping trip in town, and when she went home, there he was, already working, sifting through the fragments on her dining room table that she had brought back with her purchase. This is part of the Jerusalem Talmud. He held up a little fragment, which is very rare. May I take it away? Mrs. Lewis immediately gave her consent that he had become so fascinated on a rather dirty, torn piece of paper. Whoever amongst scholars 3 years ago, she was later to write, said any store whatever by such a piece of Hebrew paper. Schechter, however, had a hunch that it might be the Hebrew text of Ecclesiastes lost for nearly 1,000 years. He hastened to the Cambridge Library, and from there he wrote a note to Lewis later on that afternoon, May the 13th, 1896. I think we have reason to congratulate ourselves, for the fragment, he says, I took with me represents a piece of the original Hebrew Ecclesiasticus. It is the first time that such a thing was discovered. It was to become the first of a long series of discoveries that were occurred for the next 80 years. He says, it is the first time that such a thing was discovered. Please do not speak yet about this matter till tomorrow. Then he confused his time. He said he'd be there about 11 o'clock. Mrs. Lewis was soon to learn that in the excitement, Schechter not only confused time, but his instructions to the ladies to be secretive. He spluttered the good news to the first people he could run into. And returning to his wife, he could hardly contain himself. Highly impulsive, he greeted her, "As long as the Bible lives, my name shall not die. Now," he says, "telegraph Mrs. Lewis and Mrs. Gisborne to come immediately." The ladies actually received the telegram before they'd received the note. Mrs. Lewis thought with intense amusement and gratification about the discovery, and she was to write her thinking. She was very much concerned about the misogynist attitude of Ben Sira, the Hebrew author of Ecclesiastes, for not one woman, Deborah, Ruth, or Judith, or anyone, figures in his celebrated catalog of Hebrew heroes. He only praised famous men and in the well-known lines. Indeed, in one of the apothegms, he says, "Better is the wickedness of a man than the goodness of a woman." But Mrs. Lewis pointed out with glee, his original utterances were brought under the eyes of a European scholar by 2 women. In 1895, just a year before Schechter's discovery, when the revisers of the Authorized Version published their new translation of the Apocrypha, they regretfully said in the preface of Ecclesiasticus that considerable attention was paid to the text, but the material for correcting it was but scanty. And now the new discovery invalidated these regrets. The recovery of the Hebrew original was to settle quite a few of the textual problems. At the same time, a blow had been dealt once again to the higher critics. Even until the mid-years of 1940s and 50s, there were very few that expected any great documentary discoveries to be made to confirm the Old Testament. Until the recent finds in the Qumran caves, which also agreed completely with the Geneva materials and corroborated Schechter's views, many of the higher critic attitudes prevailed. A contemporary of Schechter wrote, "After all its travels through the ages, and after traversing a whole continent, this insignificant fragment had, by the luckiest of chances, fallen in the hand of the one man prepared by his previous studies to identify it, and it was as if a lost page of the Bible had been restored by modern scholarship." But Schechter was to contribute more than just that. Even though Schechter is often called the discoverer of the Ginza, he himself refused to take no credit for it. Schechter's contribution is not lessened because it was preceded by other visitors or others that preceded him there. He has the distinction of having traced to the Geneva of Cairo all of the numerous Hebrew documents which had appeared on the market for some time. It was Schechter who put a stop to the arbitrary scattering of the precious manuscripts by the unscrupulous synagogue attendants and dealers. To clear the entire Geneva and bring its contents to Europe was his grand design. Schechter had no sooner conceived the project to spirit away the Geneva than he obtained the backing of some of the top men in Cambridge University. His chief sponsor was Charles Taylor, as we mentioned earlier, a wealthy son of London merchants. He supplied the funds for Schechter's expedition. With these credentials and considerable amount of social affability, Schechter embarked on his journey to Egypt. Everything he was to say was calculated to satisfy the needs of the European tourist when he arrived in Cairo, but it is sadly modern, and my heart sank within me, he reflected, that this was the place whence I was expected to return laden with spoils, the age of which would command respect even on our ancient seats of learning. But a visit to the most reverend grand rabbi of Cairo, Shimon, to whom he submitted his introductory testimonials, soon restored his spirits, and he was promised full support. Since the belonging of the synagogue were held in trust by the rabbi and the warden, Schechter also had to earn the goodwill of the presence of the Jewish community. But the rabbi was the key man. Schechter won him over. Schechter wrote facetiously to his wife a few days later, "The rabbi is very kind to me and kisses me on the mouth, which is not very pleasant." In the same letter, he could also report that he was already at work and he had just taken away two big sacks filled with fragments. Schechter, the most outgoing of men, made friends with everybody, and suddenly Cairo seemed a glorious place. The Geneva was located at the far end of the ladies' gallery at the western side of the synagogue. Entrance to this secret recess was through a high hole up in the wall, to which one had to climb with a crude ladder. Mrs. Lewis and Mrs. Gibson joined Schechter in Cairo during the period that he examined the contents and was allowed to peek into the chamber from which had issued so many ragged scraps of writing. They were shocked to watch an attendant jump down through the hole and stood there while they heard the crash of ancient vellum beneath his feet. Schechter was taken to the synagogue by the chief rabbi himself. At first he was altogether awed by the enormous quantity of the material. As we mentioned, over 250,000 documents have been identified, and much more undoubtedly are in the hands of other people throughout the world. He was awed by the state of confusion it was in, though authorized to claim as much as he wanted. But he had no other choice. He had to be selective. And in view of the abundance of the material, some selection had to be exercised. Weeks of drudgery followed, day by day, working in the windowless storeroom. Schechter inhaled the dust of centuries. He even had to finally undergo medical treatment, and the dust from the ancient Cairo Geneva may have contributed to his death. Norman Bentwich says that the work in the Geneva room turned the robust scholar into an old man and almost broke his health. Realizing that, under such difficult circumstances, he could not do the job himself, Schechter finally hesitantly accepted the offer of attendants and their numerous kinfolk to help. Then he was initiated into the complex Oriental etiquette, which under the name of Bakshish calls for lavish remuneration, bribes, rudely demanded, but ever so graciously accepted by the natives in return for little or no services whatsoever rendered. In view of his former course of life, Schechter was ill-prepared for this humiliating and inefficient practice. To his dismay, he heard that the dealer in Cairo's were still offering fragments from the Geneva for sale, and he had no choice but to buy them back at an exorbitant price. However, an appeal to the Jewish community stopped the practice at least for a while. The hoard that he gathered was packed into huge sacks, whose number steadily increased. By the end of January, there were 30. Schechter wrote to his friend in England, the work was done. He had filled a great many sacks, some 350, and large boxes with the fragments. The British Embassy in Cairo helped to get permits for the removal of the boxes out of Egypt, and they finally arrived safely in the University Library in Cambridge. But Schechter himself remained and took a trip on into Palestine from Cairo, but he left behind a great deal of material. In 164 boxes that he cataloged over the years, the material included biblical texts, versions of the Bible, Midrash, Masorah, Mishnah, Talmud, responses of the Genoim, liturgy, documents and letters, miscellaneous, medicine, polemics, Arabic fragments, documents, philosophy, amulets, rabbinic materials, fragments bound in volumes, and many other fragments by the thousands. Of similar importance to the Bensira material was another text described in the Genesia and published by Schechter under the not very fortunate title, Fragments of a Zadokite Work. This was one of his great contributions. This work was by an author who left Jerusalem and withdrew to Damascus when he founded a schismatic sect of which previously nothing was known. The book gives in the original Hebrew the sect's own account of its origin, its accession from the Jews in Judea and migration to the region in Damascus, its organization and the laws under which lived. The religious conceptions it contained, the figure of the Messiah and the expected development of history was recently discussed in new books by Rowley because an identical document was found among the Dead Sea Scrolls. Information on the Sabbath, observances, uncleanliness, purification, oaths and vows, and the lawfulness of certain things were contained in this particular document of the Zadokites. It would be impossible to list the prodigious wealth of this collection of manuscripts, not all of which has been identified as yet. Schechter's cherished plan of having a complete catalog of all the materials and a collection in print is today as far from fulfillment as it ever was. As late as 1959, after 60 years' work, Paul E. Kale, author of one of the most comprehensive works on the Cairo Genzia, recently reprinted in cross reprints from Munich, Germany, which I have a copy, stated, "Even today, after 60 years of thorough examination of the fragments, results in the most outstanding discoveries, continued discoveries. It will still be a long time before this great treasure can be used to its full advantage." Yet today, half a century after these remarks, those rich possibilities have barely begun to be looked into. In biblical studies alone, the Genzia started a new era whose end is not yet in sight, comparable in significance and ramification to that ushered in by the Dead Sea Scrolls. With some justification, scholars have spoken of the age of the Genesia preceding, in their science, the age of the caves. So for the first 50 years of this present century, scholarly world was dominated by the great discoveries of the Cairo Genesia. Then after the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls and their first publication in 1951, we've had 30 years of the Age of the Caves. And now with discoveries of monasteries in the Coptic Desert, in the Mount Sinai Monastery, St. Kathleen, and other places, we're now entering a third age, the Age of the Monasteries. As Schechter and other scholars probed further into the dusty piles, more and more lost works emerged. Enough was found to suit any literary, historical, religious, or philological individual, and to launch many a budding scholar on a career. There was, for instance, a treatise by Philo, translated in Arabic on the Ten Commandments, and a provocative work by an unknown Jewish skeptic. Yes, a Jewish skeptic of the 10th century dealing with the oldest collection of biblical difficulties by a Jew. He was a rationalist that seemed to have been the predecessor of Abelard, who found inconsistencies in composition and content in the Old Testament. It was the second generation of Genzia students who began to look into the historical background. Dr. Zviv Falk was one of those who had gone to Cambridge looking for legal documents, for he was a professor of law at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And what did he find? A Jewish tradition to the life of Christ? 60 years after the opening of the Cairo Genzia, scholars admitted that they were just starting to tap the wealth of material available. So much of value is constantly being found that historians have to confine themselves to comparatively narrow aspects or periods. to grasp the magnitude of the task, it must be realized that more than 250,000 diagrams from the old synagogue have been assembled throughout the world, or known. The Geniza record reflects a society that was far in advance of Europe in the 10th century in Egypt, and indicates thereby that many of the institutions and practices of the emergent West, particularly in trade, finance, and contractual law, was fully anticipated on the other side of the Mediterranean. By its very nature, the Geniza could be expected to contain considerable portions of the Apocrypha, the Pseudepigrapha, and kindred literature, which is so interesting and important and contains so many parallels to Mormon doctrines. Tape 97. Gives you an indication, because among the Ginza material are very vital confirmations of Mormon doctrine. There was an extensive Aramaic portion also of what is generally considered to be a Christian apocryphon. There was the Testament of the 12 Patriarchs. The Jewish work includes chapters of Rabbi Eliezer and the Seder by Elijah, attributed to Elijah himself, and evidence of Jewish religious history in development between the New Testaments. Around the turn of the century, Schechter took a closer look at this work we mentioned earlier, the Book of the Zedekites, this sectarian work which was to fascinate him for nearly a decade, until finally he published it to the world with related pieces called by him Fragments of a Zedekite Work. It is now better known as the Damascus Document. The publication raised virtually an academic and doctrinal storm, and a long drawn out, frequently acrimonious debate ensued. The general public took very little notice. Much of the debate, however, has been resolved by the Dead Sea Scrolls. Schechter was right. Only a few men grasped the full implications of the Damascus document, borne out so persuasively by the discovery of the Qumran community and its libraries some 50 years later, in 1945 and coming to light in about 1950. Solomon Schechter no longer had a part in these developments because he had died in 1915. But he had sensed as keenly as anyone the problems posed by the Geniza discoveries. Immersed in his labors, he wrote, "Looking over this enormous mass of fragments about me, in the sifting and examination of which I'm now occupied, I cannot overcome a sad feeling stealing over me that I shall hardly be worthy to see all the results which the Geniza will add to our knowledge of Jews and Judaism. The work is not for one man, not for one generation. It will occupy many a specialist and much longer than a lifetime. However, to use an old adage, it is not thy duty to complete the work, but neither art thou free to desist from it." Let's look a little bit now into some of the contributions that the Cairo Ginza has made. Perhaps a quote by the Damascus document, or from the Damascus document, translated by Dr. Vermeij, one of the archaeologists and translators working the Dead Sea Scrolls. This is from the Damascus document, and here Latter-day Saints will find great parallels, for this opposes most Christianity and even Jewish tradition. "For God chose them not from the beginning of the world, but before, a doctrine of preexistence well laid out, 52 references in the Dead Sea Scrolls to the Father of our spirits. And in each one of the epochs he knew their works, and he held in abomination the generations of their congregation, hid his face from the land at the time of their destruction. He knew the years of their office. God knew the number and exact epochs of their appointed time from all eternity and forevermore, and that which shall befall at the appointed time all the years of the world. In each epoch, in each of them, he raised up for himself men called by name, that they might people the face of the universe with their seed." You mean you can bear seed in everlasting rejoicing in the glorious life of eternity? According to these ancient documents, yes. And then this sentence has such great portent: "God made known his Holy Spirit unto them through his anointed one." The document is 176 years B.C. "Elohim made known Ruach unto them through his Messiah." Extraordinary. In Greek, translated into English, it would mean, "God made known the Holy Spirit unto them through his Christ." The translator of that text, Dr. Vermeij, quietly left his church, the Catholic Church, because of the significance of the content of these Jewish documents. Burkitt issued a from the Kairogenzia an edition of Aquila's translation of the Bible. This was one of the earliest publications that came from the Geniza, and a great contribution to our understanding of the biblical text. Up until now, only the text of the second column of this fragment had ever been known, containing the Hebrew text in Greek letters. In this text, the Hebrew vowels are written in the oldest example of a vocalized Hebrew text which we possess, and gives us essential facts of Hebrew pronunciation during the 2nd century A.D. Another fragment of wide interest was published by Schechter in 1913. He called it an unknown Khazar document. Now, who are the Khazars? The Khazars formed a mighty kingdom to the north of the Caspian Sea and the Black Sea, with a capital on the lower Volga called Itil. We hear that the king of the Khazars and the upper classes had turned to Judaism during the caliphate of Harun al-Rashid, 786 A.D. The Khazars were defeated by the Russians in the second half of the 10th century. This is most exciting. For the Jews, the Khazar kingdom is of special interest. It is besides the Jewish kingdom in Adabin in the middle of the 1st century, the only Jewish kingdom which came into existence after the beginning of the Christian era and the dispersion under Titus of the Jews. In about 1577, a certain Isaac Abraham Arish published in Constantinople a little pamphlet called The Voice of the Messenger Good News, intended to encourage the spirit of the Jews by proving that there are known places where Israel possessed kings with strength and power. And here he included correspondence between Joseph, the Jewish king of the Khazars, and a Jewish physician and high official in the court of the Umayyad Caliph, and Nasser, who ruled in Cordova in Spain from A.D. 912 to 961. Among the manuscripts collected by Firkowitz, there was an old fragment containing a copy of the letter sent by King Joseph Chisidei. Chisidei had received some news about the Jewish kingdom of the Khazars and an address to the king, a letter in Hebrew, in which he told him something of the conditions under which he was living in Cordova. Firkowitz had shown the fragment to Chosawan in 1870. When, after Firkowitz's death, his collection came to the Russian Public Library in Petersburg, the document was rediscovered and published in a German translation. It may be that the fragment belonged to the bundles of fragments which Firkowitz had acquired from the Cairo Geniza. Now, Schechter found a second Hebrew fragment concerning the Khazars, which undoubtedly came also from the Cairo Geniza. It was written by one of the entourage of the Khazar king. It contains reports on the conversion of the Khazars to Judaism and many historical and geographical details. Why is this important? It's because out of the Crimea, we have received some of the great texts confirming Mormon doctrine, the Third Book of Enoch and the Second Book of Enoch, and other fabulous documents, the Apocalypse of Abraham and the Testament of Abraham, utilized by Hugh Nibley in his new book, Abraham in Egypt. So this is a very important material. Finally, a systematic investigation of the whole material of a special kind may, if someone undertakes it, lead to historical discoveries and to important conclusions, and may prove of much greater value than the publication of these earlier fragments. How much material found in the Geniza has increased our knowledge of the medieval liturgical poetry of the Jews? A great deal. Previously, there were five early poets that have been mentioned, among these Janne and Phinehas. In fact, there were only about five poems available of Phinehas, but here we have poems discovered by him in the Geniza. He was the head of the rabbinical school in Tiberias, which flourished about A.D. 800. And of Janne, we only had, prior to the Geniza discovery, a single poetical composition. However, since that time, many more fragments of Janne's poetry has been discovered on Geniza fragments here and there, and a systematic investigation of more than 10,000 photographs of Geniza fragments in the Research Institute for Hebrew Poetry in Jerusalem alone enabled Zule to publish in 1938 a large volume of 438 pages with 177 different compositions and fragments containing more than 800 poems of Janne, collected from 175 Geniza fragments. By 1938, Zule of the Shokin Research Institute for Hebrew Poetry Jerusalem had examined more than 10,000 of these fragments, and this great volume was presented to the world. How important might this be? Listen, these poems of Janet are not the only remnants of liturgical poetry which have come down to us from that time. Zele also established the fact that the korabas devoted to the Mishmarah must have been composed at nearly the same time. Now, contained in these are the names of these classes, as mentioned in 1 Chronicles, the priestly classes. After the destruction of the temple, A.D. 70, we find these priestly classes and families living in certain villages or towns of Galilee, each class at a special place. Here they kept alive the memory of their former service in the temple, genealogical criteria that they were priests, and eagerly hoped for the day when the temple would be reinstated and they could begin their services there again. To these 24 Mishmarot, these korobas are devoted. To each Mishmar, one koroba, provided for the service of the very Sabbath day on which the Mishmar would have been in office had the temple still been in existence. They had maintained their calendar and their offices and activities of the temple, should it ever be reinstated. This practice must have been in use at the time in the service of the synagogues. For us, this fact is surprising. A rite of that kind is nowhere else mentioned. Of these 24 korobas, nearly one half are preserved in the Geniza fragments also. We find from the Geniza fragments that the Jews in the Byzantine Empire disagreed among themselves for a long time about the way in which synagogue service was to be held. A considerable number of Greek-speaking Jews were not satisfied with the practice of reading only the Hebrew text of the scriptures in these services. They demanded that besides the Hebrew text, a Greek translation should be read. It was decided that the Greek translation of the Holy Scriptures should be omitted beside the Hebrew text, and the Septuagint became recommended. There is a great deal of material that time won't permit dealing with the Septuagint and its preservation down through time and its ultimate use by many other religions today. For example, after its redemption, this is during the period of the Crusades, which refers to the release of biblical codices which had been seized by the Crusaders in 1099 when they had taken over Jerusalem. These codices were released a few years afterwards. Our information comes again from source material in the Kara Geniza. The booty of Jerusalem, which had been looted by the Crusaders, refers to those things which were seized by the Crusaders after they took Jerusalem on the 15th of July, 1099. Thus, these manuscripts were released by King Baldwin a few years later. We hear then from the Kara Geniza of a thanksgiving service held in the synagogue of Annan, the founder of Karaism in Jerusalem, on the occasion of the release of the holy books on July the 13th, 1106. We may suppose that the books which had belonged to the Rabbinites were released at the same time. So important historical information and continuity comes from these ancient documents. What we knew until recently of the activity of the Masoretes was not very reliable. It's from the Masoretes we get our present King James text, for it was based on the Masoretic text of the 9th century. It was impossible to go behind the text created by them. But now, given the new material found in the Geniza, it should be possible to arrive at a truly historical understanding of this work. There is no doubt that the Jews owe the uniform text of the Bible to the work of the Masoretes. The history of the development of the Targums supplies important clues to a better development of the histories of the Septuagint. It also eliminates problems of the Old Syriac Gospels, and a great deal of Targumic material was involved in the Kara Geniza. We see that there was a letter which deals with the Greek version of the Torah, approved by the Jewish community of Alexandria, a version regarded as a standard text. No addition, no revisions, no omissions. Everyone to be cursed who should make an alteration. It is clear that the Jews in Egypt must have had their law in a Greek translation in much earlier times. So we may hold that the translation for which the letter of Aristeus was propaganda was not the first translation of the Jewish law. It was a revised translation. Philo gives an interesting report of the annual festival held in memory of that translation. By the commission entrusted with the translation, there was selected by the community of Alexandria this particular Septuagint tradition. As we have seen, the Jews in Palestine had been accustomed to translate their Torah and other books of the Bible into Aramaic. The Jews in Egypt translated their Hebrew Torah into Greek, in the language spoken there. The translation may have been made as soon as it became necessary, about 300 B.C. or earlier. The Jews in Egypt needed a Greek Torah perhaps more than their brethren needed an Aramaic one in Palestine and a Hebrew one elsewhere. Much of the material contained in the Kairo Geniza has resulted, therefore, in revisions made in the text of our present Bibles. Solomon Schechter himself was involved in the great Jewish undertaking, which was accomplished finally on September the 27th, 1916, in the revised edition and the Jewish Publication Society's presentation of the Holy Scriptures of the Jews. He died in 1915, but most of the work to which he contributed was completed. A little bit more detail about Schechter will be of interest to show his importance. In 1897, he was named the Goldsmith Professor of Hebrew at the University of London, and then in 1892, he accepted a post at the Theological Seminary of America, New York, and then as that president of that group, he published his Documents of the Jewish Sectaries in 1910. He became the first Jew to receive this distinction when in the following year, Harvard University conferred on him the degree of Doctor of Letters. In 1913, he founded the United Synagogue of America as a movement of conservative Judaism which sought to offset the Reform movement which began in Germany prior to 1819. So he was a very important person in terms of the founder of the conservative movement. During his career as president, Solomon Schechter was one of the editors of the Jewish Quarterly Review and the translation of the Bible published by the Jewish Publication Society. However, this translation did not appear until after his death. Solomon Schechter, the Kairo Geniza, and its contents are such great and vital importance. There is also material dealing with the Ben Berechiah Joseph found among the Geniza deposits, tape 114, by my son Ronell Erickson, provides insight, and also tape number 80. We have not exhausted at all the impact and influence of the Kairo Geniza. And then that first one that I quoted to you is most exciting, for it will now call your attention to the tremendous prophecies found in the Book of Mormon regarding the Jews. A few decades ago, if you were to mention the name Jesus in a synagogue, the rabbi would have departed, would have left. Now, they're actually translating Jewish traditions of Jesus Christ, finding material in their own synagogues, in their ancient archives, material that they used actually to deal with proselyting activity of the Christians. In the 10th century, when proselyting activity of the Christians attempted to deal with the Jews, we find, had more information concerning Christ than was in circulation among the Christians themselves. The document that was translated by Zeville Falk has also resulted now in confirmation that Josephus was correct, and a whole new book concerning Josephus and the so-called interpolations by Christian hands of references to John and Christ in the works of Josephus now is being entirely re-examined. The Kairo Geniza, one of the great discoveries of this century, 250,000 documents about which so little is known, occupying men now into the second generation. Joseph Smith anticipated such great discoveries, and the Book of Mormon is filled with anticipation of what will happen as the Jews find from their own sources confirmation and expectations. Now may we get a testimony of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. These ancient documents are just simply nice to know about. They're fantastic. They're astonishing. They reveal a great deal of material. They're educating people all over the world in terms of certain thinking and ideas. But what it all boils down to, the legacy of the prophet Joseph Smith, the great Joseph, is a restoration. Confirmation of the restoration is exciting, but we must have the indelible witness of the Holy Ghost. And when we get it, keep it in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.